Hello, and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we want to talk about some of the interesting findings from the American Heart Association scientific sessions, which recently occurred in Chicago. And there was some really interesting data that came out. So to start off, we are actually going to talk about a new study addressing blood pressure in people with diabetes. It's called the BP Road. And I thought this was like done. I thought like finally we came to consensus on blood pressure goals. But now this new study really, I think, throws some new evidence into the picture, which may lead us to rethinking our guidelines yet again. So I can recap it. So basically, this was a study. It was a randomized controlled trial, large, multi-center, international, where they actually randomized 12,821 participants that had type 2 diabetes and hypertension. And they randomized them to a blood pressure target of less than 120 versus less than 140. And these are people that had at least one additional cardiovascular risk factor. And in terms of their primary outcome, they were looking at cardiovascular outcomes. So what they found was that the combination of non-fatal stroke or MI or heart failure or treatment of hospitalizations or cardiovascular death, comparing that 120 versus 140, that the 120 actually had a lower rate of these events. It was 1.65% versus 2%, 2.09%. And that was actually a 21% reduction, so a hazard ratio of 0.79. And this was found to be statistically significant. So, Natalie, what do you think? What do you think the clinical significance of this is?
Right. So we always get studies, you and I, and we say, okay, what does this do to our practice for our patients tomorrow when I see the first person in the morning? I think a couple of things came to mind as soon as I read this study. One of them is that, you know, we use Epic in our practice, and Epic flags blood pressures that are very high, right? We're talking, I don't even know off the top of my head, is it 150 over 90 and flags above that? Wait a minute. We need to go back. It needs to be flagging a whole lot lower if that's what, you know. And of course, as a clinician, I've trained myself to say, I always look at blood pressure. Lots of times we repeat them the second time while they're in the office because people get nervous as they walk in the door. They think they're in trouble. They think, right, all kinds of crazy. So I think that, you know, we are looking to drive blood pressure down. I don't think we're looking to drive blood pressure less than 120 or haven't in the past. So this would really change our clinical practice. You know, we've always said lots of, and again, then what are the other sides of this? And then as a patient's age, we can't expect that. We can't do it because they'll get dizzied with that lower blood pressure, or can tend to. But it does change my thoughts around driving the blood pressure down in those appropriate people with diabetes and look at the difference in outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I think the side effects are a good point. There were higher rates of hypokalemia, so low potassium and hypotension, but not a ton more. So it appears, at least in this trial, benefit was worth the risk. Although on an individual basis, if someone's going to take like five meds to get to that lower blood pressure for an individual, it may not be worthwhile.
But that's the whole idea of it, is maybe we're not driving it down. Right. That idea that there weren't that many side effects, but we're always like, well, we don't want them to get dizzy when they tie their shoes. We don't want that. But the rates of hypotension, the complaints of it, actually, and the symptomatic hypotension, I guess, weren't that great. So, but we always say, well, they're going to get symptomatic. And so maybe they're going to get dizzy. But maybe we just say that. Maybe they're not really going to get, right? So do we owe it to that person to try, especially for those younger, you know, less than, you know, of course we wouldn't do this with frail people. We wouldn't do this when we got to a point where the benefit might outweigh the risk, but are we missing those people? And I think the answer is yes, I do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends a little bit on how many meds the person's on. I mean, I'm totally with you. If someone can achieve this goal in two or three meds, then it's like probably the side effects, because you can use first line agents, probably the side effect profile will be worth it. But when you do get into those cases of resistant hypertension where someone's needing like a fourth agent, even fifth agent, then you kind of start to wonder, because some of those additional agents do have more side effects. So that's where I think like there's always some level of individualization. But the whole thing, I don't know, I'm just fascinated by all of this, because over the years, we really, our guidelines have changed a lot. So for the longest time is actually 140 over 90. Well, actually it was like 130 over 80, then it was 140 over 90. In 140 over 90 seemed to stick for a little while, because we didn't have strong evidence that lowering it much more than that really led to more benefits. And then the Sprint trial came out, which did was like this, where it did 140 versus 120 and showed that there was a benefit in that 120. But people with diabetes were not included in that trial. So for all the rest of the world, we kind of said, okay, let's lower this blood pressure target. For people with diabetes, we had a lot of controversy. Some left it at 140 over 90. Then we started to see 140 over 80. And then in the last couple of years, we did see the ADA then went down to 130 over 80. And there's at least been consensus amongst the organizations with that 130 over 80. Now I have to wonder, with this new trial, how are the guidelines going to treat this? Are we going to try to go for 120 over 80 now? Because we see that there was quite a benefit, a 21% reduction in these cardiovascular events. So it's really, I mean, this could be game changing.
I think so, too. And I think that, again, it's all about, you know, yes, we need to think about this with an individual person in front of us. But as a whole, we need to retrain our brains to say, okay, you know, that 120 level, we need to be looking for above 120 versus above 130. And then decide, okay, let's dive into the med list. How many meds are they on? What kinds of things would interact if we had to add, you know, more medications or increase medication?
I think, you know, this is definitely newer, more current data. There was also on statins, which is definitely a positive thing. But when I look deeper down, actually, the percentage of patients on GLP-1s and SGLT2 inhibitors was a little bit expect. So to put it in perspective, metformin, which is often still our first line agent, was about 66 or 67% in the two groups. GLP-1 agonists were actually 4.4 and 4.3%. It was a much, much smaller. And then SGLT2 inhibitors, about 10%. So it's kind of interesting, because we know those have cardiovascular benefits well. And so I would have liked to see those a little bit higher in this trial, but they were a little bit on the lower side.
I agree. I don't know that. I think that I would love to see the data on those particular subsets of patients, just to see if there was an increase or decrease, because we're using them and we're using them based on ADA guidelines. You know, the guidelines say if their risk is high, don't even look at their C or their time and range, do it anyway, right? To reduce those cardiovascular or kidney risks. So I would love to see that drilled down data. You know, the SGLT2 inhibitors, you know, almost 700 out of the 6,300 patients were on SGLT2 inhibitors. GLP-1s, 283 out of those 6,300. So I would like to see that data to see if that drove a difference and that comparator was the same or not. Was it still 29% risk reduction in that lower blood pressure?
Yeah. I mean, they did do some subgroup analysis, yep. But they didn't do those.
They didn't do those, right? Yeah.
They're not.
I'd like to see her.
I mean, there's not enough people in the groups to really power those. Yeah. But I agree. It would definitely be interesting to see.
You could just see what, even if you can't say that it's statistically significant, is there any kind of, can you see a difference?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Awesome. Well, next article that we want to talk about is actually, and this was presented at AHA, the tirzepatide in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So, Natalie, you want to introduce that article?
Sure, absolutely. So, again, another great. So, neither one of us has went to AHA this year, by the way.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And now we both, I think, we're having like FOMO, right? We're fear. We like it was like, oh, I should have gone to AHA. So another great, great study. This was an international study, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled, on a one-to-one ratio with 731 patients with heart failure, an ejection fraction of at least 50%, and a body mass index of at least 30 to receive tirzepatide, and up to 15 milligrams once per week, or placebo for at least 52 weeks. So a longer study. The two primary endpoints of composite adjudicated death from cardiovascular cases or worsening in a heart failure event, right, which was assessed in the time to first event analysis. And the change from baseline to 52 weeks in the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire. So a clinical summary score, and scores range from 0 to 100 for those of you that don't know, with higher scores indicating better quality of life. So that's what was looked at. And a total of 364 patients were assigned to the tirzepatide group. And the median duration of follow-up was actually 104 weeks. So death from cardiovascular causes or worsening of heart failure occurred in 36 patients in the tirzepatide group and 56 patients in the placebo group. So with a hazard ratio of 0.62, so worsening of heart failure occurred in 29 patients or 8% of the tirzepatide group and 14% in the placebo group. So I think that this is important, but also the other side of it at 50 in the assessment score, right, was 19% in the 19 points in the tirzepatide group compared with 12 points in the placebo group. So, and then adverse events, mainly GI, right, leading to discontinuation, 6.3% in tirzepatide and 1.4% in placebo. So that was the study. And I think, first of all, you know, the last thing I talked about was side effects. I think when we present use of tirzepatide, sometimes, you know, I think I'm saying that there's going to be more side effects that would actually stop use than 6. I usually use the number 10%, right? So I thought that was interesting right off the bat. But treatment led to a lower risk of composite death from cardiovascular causes or worsening of heart failure than the placebo. And also, though, improved health status in patients. So again, I think this is all about what does this do for the person? I want to reduce their cardiovascular risk, but it's also, how do they feel about it? What do they think about where we are? Again, with heart failure, with preserved ejection fraction and obesity. So Diana, what do you think?
So I think this is pretty incredible data because also a lot of our heart failure with preserved ejection fraction studies have focused on symptom management, which of course is important as well. But this, I mean, has hard cardiovascular outcomes, clearly showing benefits with hospitalization and cardiovascular death. So I think this is a big deal. And I'm going to be so curious. Again, I think this could really be a guideline changer because I could see where for people with preserved ejection fraction, that this becomes a recommended therapy. Now, one thing I'll say, this trial included people with obesity. So I think a certain percentage had type 2 diabetes, but it wasn't only people with type 2 diabetes, but even those with diabetes still had benefit. So it's like kind of going to be interesting to see how this impacts our guidelines. And do we have one pathway for those with preserved ejection fraction versus another pathway for those that have reduced ejection fraction? Like, do we start recommending SGLT2 inhibitors if they have reduced and the tirzepatide or another GLP-1 if they have preserved? And so it's really like, yeah, it's just fascinating to me.
Right. I think so too. And I think that when we are, you know, looking at how do we improve the lives of the people in front of us? How do we improve what they are, how they feel every day when they wake up in the morning, but as well as reducing their cardiovascular risk, right? So I think we have to always think about that combination. I'm excited about this. I think that this is this primary endpoint reduction is, you know, it's like adding to the list of the things that we've talked about with tirzepatide specifically, that magic GIP-GLP combination, different from other medications in the class. And I'm excited.
Yeah, I just can't believe how quickly this area is going. And just like we had no therapies for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And now Like we see the positive data with semaglutide, with tirzepatide, with finerenone. And it is, it's exciting, very exciting. So speaking of all that excitement related to the incretin therapies, there was actually another article. This wasn't at AHA, but this was actually published simultaneously while AHA was going on. And this is an analysis that was in JAMA about who, like how many people, if we're following guideline and FDA approved indication status, are eligible for semaglutide, right? And so they looked at the NHANES data. They looked at the 2015 to 2020 data, and there were over 25,000 survey participants. So it used the clinical trial eligibility for the indications for type 2 diabetes, for weight management, and also the secondary cardiovascular disease prevention. And so what they determined is that actually 35 million adults qualified for use based on that diabetes indication. 129.2 million were eligible based on its weight management indication. And then another 8.9 were considered eligible based on the secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease. So that is basically about half of the adult U.S. population. So, Natalie, what do we think about this?
It's overwhelming, isn't it? When we take a step back and think about the number of people who have obese or diabetes or a combination of the two, but then the number of people that, you know, I mean, for cardiovascular risk on top of that, half of the U.S. population, I mean, one in six people right now has diabetes. And so the numbers are just overwhelming. And I had never thought about it in these numbers before. I'd never thought about, you know, it's like I just, the next person comes in and we do what we need to do and we take care of them and we think about, you know, how do we treat and what do we do? But I don't know that I have ever taken a step back and thought 50% of America would qualify for semaglutide based on its indications alone. I think as I was looking at this, that, you know, that would be 26 million people with Medicare, for example, right? 13 million with Medicaid, and then 61 million with private insurance, if we want to look at it in a different, right? This is a lot of people that you know, it goes both ways, could use this medication. And I think there was an article, maybe by Earl Hirsch in the last year or so, that said that if everyone that got on this medication got on it, it's going to cost the system so much money. So there's like this catch 22 of who responds, who should we be using this for? And think about all those aspects of it as well. What made your gut go, oh, we should talk about this podcast? Cause that's what drove me. It was like, wow, what do we do? Where do we start?
Well, I think the numbers are so huge. And then the thing is, this doesn't even take into account the fact that now semaglutide is also approved for 12 and over. So there's a large proportion of kids that now live with obesity and type 2 diabetes. And then also the fact that it's being investigated for conditions like HFpEF as well as MASH and even others, not necessarily semaglutide, but we saw the data with tirzepatide and sleep apnea. Semaglutide, we saw the data with osteoarthritis, right? So this is kind of the tip of the iceberg because we could see the indications expand to all of these other disease states. And right now, one of the things the article says is statins are the most widely prescribed medication, which makes sense, but those are generic drugs. If this not being a generic drug, if everyone who was eligible actually got a prescription for this, it would totally overwhelm our health system. And so I am concerned about that. And I also am a big believer in people having access to good therapies. And so it's really, hopefully something could be worked out where we can continue to work on cost and access and coverage. But also, I think one other thing. So I'm a pharmacist. I love medications. I see the value and how incredible they are to save lives and have amazing outcomes. I don't think, though, we should be ignoring that there are other contributors to obesity and to type 2 diabetes. And one of those for sure is our food environment. And so I think that is something we should invest more in to have better quality food and make sure we are addressing obesity from that aspect and not just looking at increasing use of GLP-1s.
Absolutely. And I think we both are big believers in you're going to prescribe a GLP-1. We talk about, especially for those with diabetes, you know, we're using this to help bring your A1C into range. We're going to, if we are, you know, that kind of thing. And so this kind of opens a door, you know, you will feel fuller, you will, right? So let's take now to be the time that you meet with our dietitian that helps you take advantage of these medications and help you with some weight loss. Even 5% is a big deal. You know, it doesn't have to be that someone loses. We all have these stories of people losing 100 pounds and like, but, you know, we have those super responders. We have a lot of people that lose some weight, but that even some is a big deal. But I think that we need to make sure that when we are using these medications that we're maximizing all the other aspects of treatment, right? Like you know, exercise, you know, diet, all of it together to improve cardiovascular risk, as opposed to just saying, you know, okay, we're using this medication, you're going to reduce your risk. Yes, you are, but we could do it even more if you were healthier and you could walk a little further, if you could do a little more, if, you know, like, so I just want to, I, as a clinician, I always talk about exercise. I always talk about, you know, I mean, I jokingly say, eat more broccoli. I don't like broccoli. Okay, let's find a vegetable you're willing to eat more often. 3 more days a week will make a difference, right? Like, you know, so I think that a lot of times we are maybe not sending people for more counseling and help than we can do in our visit even that we could do easily with a lower cost to the system as we do it.
Right. So I just feel like, yeah, we need to focus on that too. Because also, like, we don't know. I mean, these drugs, for sure, we know they're good. They have outcomes for several years, but we don't know what happens in 10 years, 20 years. I believe they're safe. But what I don't know is, will the body start to compensate like it does for other types of weight loss where it may be more difficult to keep it? And so definitely the lifestyle will always go hand in hand with whatever medication is used and prescribed. And I believe that there's actually a new publication out about the dietitian's important role with prescribing GLP-1 therapies, and that we hope to have
because we're trying to get someone to talk to on our podcast, because it is, I think that there is a huge important role. And I think in the past we've talked about it with a couple of other people here and there, but not like focused on it. And we're excited to bring you one of our next couple of podcasts will be around the role of the dietitian, because it is integral. It is integral to this whole process. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah. So stay tuned for that. But anyway, yeah, it has just been so much news with GLP-1 incretin therapies. So thanks so much for listening to us talk about this. And we hope that you will join us for the next episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.